Coming up.
Yeah.
Is there some reason why they may be saying that?
Like, my family was just attacked by a whole lot of rich people that wanted to silence me. So, you know, it's the nature of our business.
So what do you mean they wanted to silence you?
They tried to have me declared mentally unfit so that they could basically take my access to any money, any means to be able to travel or whatever, so they could threaten my life.
But why? Why would they want to do that?
Hello and welcome to another episode of Let's Talk Man with the Gents Clinic. Six South African male medical doctors on a mission to change the way in which we perceive healthcare. Today we have got the esteemed guest, Nota Baloyi, who needs no introduction.
Thank you.
I don't know how to introduce him. He's got so many titles, wears so many caps, and he's here joining us today to discuss mental health and maybe a little bit more about the entertainment industry. Yeah. So thank you for joining us, Nota.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, Nassim is on call, but he'll join us
as soon as he gets here.
Thank you for joining us, Nota. What's up? Thank you.
Is that like a hoodie scrub, a scrub hoodie?
Yeah, this is actually our Gents Clinic hoodies. We have an online clinic for men.
Are you allowed to wear those, like, at the hospital or something?
I wear this. We're technically allowed to, but this is just marketing for our online clinic.
It looks pretty cool.
Is it?
Yeah, it looks pretty cool. I think.
Thanks, man. Thank you.
I think you should drop like tiny size ones, like little ones.
Uh-huh.
Like, do you have kids?
No.
Okay, but like for when you have kids, like tiny size, you know, like so that people who've got kids can have their men's clinic little hoodie for their babies.
I think that's a good marketing. It's not really a target
market. The thing is this, that, you know, the thing is that not many of us are doctors, right?
Yeah.
So we can't really buy like a doctor's hoodie. But if we've got a baby, you can like, oh yeah, it's my baby boy. Maybe one day he'll be a doctor.
Yeah, buy him a doctor's hoodie too.
You know what I mean?
Good plan.
Good
plan.
Good marketing.
It makes it
as well.
Sellable.
Yeah.
Definitely. So, yeah, look, I mean, we've got a lot to chat to. Let's get through all of it. Nota, where would you like to start? Who is Nota?
I think that's a good place, yeah.
Okay.
For those who are watching at home and far away, if you had to describe who you are, what you've done, what you've achieved in life, what failures or what challenges you've faced, what would you say to those people?
Yeah, so I'm Nhlamulo Baloyi. I'm a lifelong learner, so I've been learning about a whole lot of things apart from myself, you know, learning about, you know, music, culture, business, society as a whole, and learning about myself through, you know, the assistance of maybe experts from your psychologists, not so much psychiatrists, because I was advised to avoid those as a child. I was on alternative cognitive behavioral therapy type stuff, herbal stuff, you know, exercises type
as
stuff.
As a child?
Yeah. Since I was very young. I've been in the process of learning about myself actively or consciously since I was a child. Yeah. Mm. And yeah, I guess that's me, in a nutshell. Yeah.
So, very complicated.
What keeps you busy?
Ooh, yeah. That's the thing. I'm trying to find new challenges for myself, I think. I get bored very easily. Mm-hmm. Or I've always been very easily bored. Or when something just seems not challenging anymore, I sort of like switch off. Mm-hmm. So finding new hairy, audacious goals, I think, has been one of the things. And then with age, also learning to get patient, you know. When you're younger, you don't have a big perspective on life. Your life is 1 year, next grade or whatever, next Christmas, you know what I mean? That's how far you think. Or at least that's how far I thought as a child, you know what I mean? Next Christmas, I get a bicycle or whatever it is, you know. Now it's more about thinking, you know, towards my plans for when I get to like retirement age, what I want to have accomplished, how I, you know, see myself. Just, I guess, adulting in general has made me have to learn to manage my expectations of life as well, actively, to keep myself motivated. 'Cause I've tried my best to not fall into a structure that I don't arrange or put together. So, you know, I've been on an entrepreneurial journey since I was a child, and I've tried to maintain that for as long as possible. I mean, I had
what was your first entrepreneurial journey?
Selling muffins, but brand muffins.
Okay, in
brand
school.
Muffins. That's
yeah, yeah.
Okay,
like they were good for your gut health.
And were you making them
at home?
You were making the muffins.
Yeah, I made the muffins at home, selling bap and gravy. You know what I mean? Like I noticed from visiting.
Who was buying bap and gravy?
That's cool. Yeah, like we'd have like an entrepreneur day. So
oh,
I went
okay.
to
okay.
a very strange school, but it was very cool. It's called Radford House. It's in Fairlands on Cornelis Street.
Okay.
And it's like a very small boutique private school. At most, I think there were seven of us in a class or in a grade, or class grade, whatever.
Okay.
Yeah. And so we did a whole lot of activities. You know, we had Entrepreneurs Day, Enrichment Day, where we'd learn about things. You know, we do like engineering things. Mm-hmm. We do computer programming. Like this is back when that stuff was just starting. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Or to be introduced in schools. In fact, not many schools had computer labs or networked computers or anything. You'd find that at universities, and we'd even get taken on trips at school to the Rao University. They had a techno lab where, like, you know, you could make robots and stuff like that. This was in the late 90s, 98, 99, early 2000s. And so with that, I got a whole lot of different experiences. And the nice thing also about being at a well-resourced school is that, you know, the parents of the kids are, like, not just rich or accomplished, but, like, they're active business people that are at the forefront of whatever industry that they're in. You know what I mean? Mm. So you'll find, like, a certain child's dad is, like, in fiber optics. Mm. Like, who knew what fiber optics was in 1998? But we knew what fiber optics was. To the extent that, like, we'd even argue with our teachers about the limitations of our computer labs because, you know, we didn't have fiber internet or anything. But that was, like, an innovation that was going to come.
Yeah, yeah.
And as kids, we were, like, you know, far more techno-savvy than our teachers.
And tell me, Nota, so paint the journey for us, briefly paint the journey for us, going from being an entrepreneur or having entrepreneurial spirits in a private school to then progressing to becoming someone of stature in the media industry or rather the music industry.
And podcasting.
How does that happen?
Yeah, so I went to like a different high school. I went to a high school in Brixton in Crosby, which is a completely different environment. It's like an elite suburban enclave in Fairlands or the Northcliff area to Brixton Crosby, which is, you know, it's a mixed area, mixed between a lot of coloured and Indian people, but not all sorts of like Indian people, mostly the Muslim faith, you know what I mean, or Islamic faith. So there was a bit of a culture shock there, or not so much of a culture shock, but like a nice mix. You know, so I got to learn about different communities. I mean, like, at my high school on Fridays, we used to close at like 12 because, you guys have to go to Madrasa. On Friday, you guys have to go, you know what I mean? So if you go Madrasa, then we all go Madrasa.
Nota went to the school and, but how did you get into the entertainment industry?
Yeah, the entertainment industry is just like by access and proximity. So I always wanted something that gave me freedom. And entertainment gives you freedom. You know what I mean? Like, I always say this to people that, you know, work in the entertainment space, especially like talent. It's like, you know, what you don't understand as talent is that there needs to be doctors, you know. There needs to be people that work as cashiers at Pick and Pay. There needs to be, you know, a whole lot of people that buy enough iPhones for Spotify to work. You know what I mean? If 10 people that can afford iPhones that have Spotify, that's 10 people listening to the music instead of the 180 million subscribers it takes for Spotify to be a meaningful thing for the artist to escape from the mundane life of having to study for a certain profession, work a 9-to-5. So if you work in the arts, you basically get like the freedom of the rest of responsibility that other people have to take on, which is actually to work so that your livelihood can be feasible.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? If you guys are not doctors and earning decent salaries, you know what I mean? You're not buying tickets to Beyonce or whatever it is, you know?
I see what you mean, yeah.
So did you study arts?
No, I didn't. Like, I observed it.
So, literally, you leave high school, what happens next?
So it's so funny. Okay, so you know what I mean? Don't judge me for this, but like, so when I was a kid, I decided when I grow up, I'm going to be Puff Daddy. Okay. You know what I mean? Like, this was...
In what way? Because
you know what's going on now.
No, as in, like, the music mogul. Like, you know, like, as any
six-year-old... Just for the music.
As any six-year-old. Not just music, business, culture, influence, marketing, everything.
But just like, not the crazy sex.
I studied... Yeah. No, none of that.
You can tell us if you
do. No. That's not my forte. Okay. You know, I don't have the...
So, music, influence, you like... him for those reasons, yeah, that's so, what you wanted to emulate yourself.
Yeah, and also because of how much our music culture was tied to, you know, our activism, our political consciousness in this country's context, you know, specifically.
Okay.
I felt like, you know, even if I go into music, I'm not dumbing myself down to the extent that I'll be seen as like, an airhead because I chose.
Okay, so which specific genre of music you wanted to go into?
No, hip hop, like obviously.
Okay,
So you didn't do art, you observed art. And
my sister was a child star. My sister was an actress on TV.
Okay, what's your sister?
She's doctor, but an economist. Dr. Basani Baloy. She's an economist though.
And she was an actor as a child.
Yeah, she was an actor, actress, a model, a musician. She played a couple of instruments.
And so you managed her first?
No, I didn't. No, she's 6 years older than me. So I saw her. I watched her. Like, you know, I was the famous girl's little brother for a first couple of years of primary school.
Yeah.
You know, when we went to Sharon Lee Primary. She was in grade 7, I was in grade 1.
Okay.
She went to the National School of the Arts. So again, her going to the National School of the Arts, like I come from what you'd call us middle class, but like my mother was probably working class, working for the government of the state, you know. So there are benefits to that, like medical aid, you know, pension fund, housing allowance.
I was actually going to ask you how your parents were able to afford, you know, taking you to such a...
The school said they'd love to have me. So much so that my parents couldn't afford it, but the school kept me there.
Is it?
Yeah. I was lucky. I was one of those lucky. I was the token kid. So to speak. Yeah. I was like kind of like the first black learner as well. So yeah. But luckily I could keep up. So with my mother working with the state and all of that, my sister going to NSA. At NSA is like where all the rich kids who were interested in the arts went. The connected kids and everything else. You know, their parents were also the captains of industry. So it's like similar to what my primary school environment was, except on a larger scale because there was a whole lot more kids.
Okay.
So again, I got to see the level of access. And like our family didn't directly have that access, but because of who we ended up growing up around, we ended up getting that, I guess... access or skin in the game to, I guess, South Africa's elite circles and got to see how that works. So I always knew that, you know, unless you're part of the elite, you can't really dictate how your life goes. You know, your life is subject to whoever decides and if you're in their favor. So that's what gave me the pipeline and to delve deeper into the arts and music, since my sister decided she wanted to pursue economics. I think she started her degree when she started at UCT when I was in grade 7. So I was finishing primary school. So I already knew she was going into that pathway of politics, philosophy, and economics. And then I was like, oh, since you're going to give up the golden goose of your talent, you know, you can do all this stuff, I'm going to go into that field and expand. And again, because I was like, yo, when I grow up, I'm going to be Puff Daddy. By the time I was finishing primary school, I think that's when George Bush was going up against Al Gore for the U.S. presidency. And then Puff Daddy was on some, oh, vote or die. You know what I mean? Let's get involved in politics. Let's understand what's working. So, you know, I understood that, you know, there's a role in the arts and activism as well. So I wouldn't feel like, you know, a total waste.
Cool. And then how do you get in? Where does it actually happen for you? Like, where's the first moment, where's the first opportunity, like, okay, this was my moment of fame. Or moment of realization, like, I'm in the industry now.
Yeah. You know? I guess when
I always wonder, like, because I'm a comedian as well, so I understand somewhat of the entertainment industry.
Yeah.
But to be someone who's like, I just want to be the guy that manages the talent is a unique skill that most people don't want. It's oftentimes managers end up being like the artist that tried, couldn't really make it, and then says, let me just manage these guys. Yeah. Mm. So for you who's like, I want to just manage, I want to be someone who's in the business and understand the business of entertainment.
Yeah.
Where's that first moment? Like, now we understand the whole trajectory, the path, but where's the moment where you're like, I've got my first artist, I'm signing the piece of paper, I'm in the studio recording?
It didn't dawn upon me like that, because for me, it started from there. You understand? So, like, the first artist that I was exposed to, I was like, oh, I'm a fan of, is B.I.G., Notorious B.I.G., right?
Okay.
And then he was rolling around with Puff Daddy, obviously, you know, they had the music videos and everything else. And then my cousin, who knew more about hip hop, is like, no, B.I.G. is Puff Daddy's artist. As in, B.I.G., the guy you worship, works for Puff Daddy. So I was like, oh, so that's the boss. You know what I mean? And coming from an entrepreneurial family, like, my dad has never had a boss. So, like, my dad's the boss. So, like, as the boss's son, like, why would I want to be the bricklayer, you know, well, in my dad's context, because he's in construction, you know, I wouldn't want to be the bricklayer. Even though I did lay a lot of bricks at my dad's construction site, I wasn't the boss there. I was just the boss's son. You know, that was already in my mind. I want to be the boss, you know. Yeah. Like I said it in my interview, I had an interview, my first newspaper interview when I was 8 years old on the Sunday World. It was the second edition, the second printed edition of the Sunday World. And I mean, I guess they're still around, and a lot of newspapers have fallen off since. I said, I'm going to grow up to be Puff Daddy. Like, my heroes are Leonardo DiCaprio and Puff Daddy, but more so Puff Daddy.
So when did you become Puff Daddy? That's what we want to know.
From that moment, because I started, you know, writing songs, making music, you know, making beats. I got the software that's
so producing.
Could allow
you
to
actually
arrange.
Started
learning with a computer. Yeah.
Okay. Do you
so, like,
it yourself? Okay.
Like, think about it like this: we kids who started, like, remember I told you at my primary school, we were already programming computers. We were making our own games. Like, we'd sit, make our own games. You know what I mean? Like, we'd hack into networks. We'd be able to download things off certain sites. And my mother worked at Eskom as well. Eskom had like the fastest internet in the country, like in the early 90s. They had like, but like a
back
super
when they
internet.
Still worked. Yeah.
No, they still like their intranet, like internally, their intranet was like at home, we'd have like 128K or whatever, the dial up, it would go, you know, it would make that noise, and then it would load a bit. But as when we had Eskom, we could load whatever we want. So, Eskom at Megawatt Park, all the staff, could bring their kids during school holidays. Like, even right now, well, I guess, I hope they still have it. Well, actually, we wasted a lot of money doing that. So I hope they don't have it anymore. But yeah, because like, we used to like pour like, we had chocolate fountains, we had soda fountains, like, we'd have a Fanta mixed with Coca-Cola, mixed with Sprite, like, all in one. Yeah, we'd.
This was the taxpayer's money, yeah?
Yeah.
Rate based.
Fanta mixed dashing.
So
no Fanta.
Yeah, we're dashing. So that technology, like, environment exposed me to everything that was high tech. So music was one of those things that were high tech. So I learned the production as part of learning about computers. It was like one of those things. Like there's software you can make music on. You're learning computers. You learn how to use all the software.
Yeah. Cool. So who have you managed?
Well, I wouldn't say I've managed, but you know, I own a record company, and
what's the name of the record company?
It's called Urbantainment, or BNS Projects, under BNS Projects, we've released two albums and a couple of singles, a couple of titles. We released Questa Dakar and Dakar 2, as well as the singles, a whole lot of singles, including Spirit, Run It Up.
So is Chris one of your artists? Or?
Yeah, he's one of the artists that's recorded under my label.
Okay.
But so not you don't your... actually manage him?
No. So he's,
okay.
No,
so
no,
you're
no.
not the he's not, not the,
no, well, I mean, in terms of for the projects that we did together, yes.
Oh, okay.
I'm the Puff Daddy for that. But,
yeah.
No, everything else, he's his own
Diddy. So I don't know if you know, but July is men's mental health.
July as well. Okay.
Yeah. July as well.
Yeah.
So we're celebrating men's mental health.
Lovely.
And obviously that's why we also wanted to have you, you know, part of the session and have us men just talk about some of the challenges we have as men.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of the challenges that society has, especially considering the fact that, you know, stats actually confirm that suicide in men is actually four to five times higher than that of females.
Yeah.
And this is people who actually are successful.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, females actually attempt suicide more than men.
Yeah.
But we seem to be leading as you
in
know,
the success
yeah,
rate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think are the possible challenges? Like, why do you think men
suffer more?
Suffer more from, you know, committing suicide and.
Yeah, I think that men don't get the skills, like mental skills, like, you know, coping skills. And, you know, I find this a lot of in my encounters with a lot of people, like a lot of guys as well. The difference in our backgrounds, like me personally as an individual and a lot of guys that I've grown up around. You know, my parents were very invested in my mental health since I was a child. You know, like I said, I've had the assistance of psychologists and psychiatrists since the age of four. So it was never a strange thing speaking to a professional about how I feel or what I'm going through. So I've always had like additional help throughout my life. I think the first time... I remember the day that I stopped taking Ritalin. Like, I was put on Ritalin, I think, late grade 11 and early into my matric year, but before we wrote exams. And I remember the first time that I'd turned 18, and then my psychiatrist had to ask for consent to prescribe me more Ritalin, and then I declined. Because it was giving me, like, anxiety attacks, you know. I had an incident once where I was driving, and I had to hop out of the car because I was having an anxiety attack. Because of the Ritalin, right? And also, like, you're taking Ritalin and you're also sleep deprived because of studying for exams, you know, like, you know, sleeping at maybe 4 a.m., wake up at 6, and then, you know, it's a whole week that you're doing that, and then you're also behind the wheel driving a car, you know. So it was a compound effect, not just the medication itself. Yeah, too many men don't have that same experience that I had. And therefore, internally, they don't have the coping mechanisms. You know what I mean? So,
Are the coping mechanisms?
I mean, for them, they escape. They don't cope. So, like drinking, you know, taking drugs, you know, risky behavior, you know, being daredevils or whatever the case may be. Like, I'm just using the euphemism of daredevil, but you can just imagine any number of... risky behaviors people find take them away from the issues of processing negative thoughts, you know what I mean, and understanding the difference between, you know, their perception and invasive thoughts, you know, like sometimes people can't tell themselves that what they're thinking is not something that is consistent with, you know, what they believe in or whatever, and then they shame themselves for whatever they end up thinking. And with that shame, then they also struggle to express. And because they can't express themselves with other people and relate to one another, you know, there's certain things that might be an issue for you. I don't know if you've got siblings or brothers or sisters or anything else, but sometimes you're seeing something as an issue. And until you speak about it to someone else, you know, you don't understand that it's not really a big deal. So we've also lost our community. We've lost our village as people. And we live very individualistic lives. And the rate at which our lives have become individualistic is also very fast. We did not, our development trajectory, I don't know where everyone grew up, right? But I grew up close to here in four ways. But like Sandton City, as a construct, you know, as an environment, is something that I'm very familiar with, and its transitions, you know. So it's become very individualized. I mean, Sandton City used to be packed. Like, you'd know that 4 p.m., it's chock-a-block in Sandton. It's no longer the case, and it's not because of COVID or anything else. It's a process that's happened gradually over time, but it's gotten empty.
So you think that people are just less connected than they were before?
So disconnected.
Do you think like it's a problem of urban society? Do you feel like... Because I also wonder, like, in the rural areas, if the numbers are the same when it comes to suicide. I wonder because there, or at least my thinking is that there you've got tribe, you've got community, you've got people around you. You may not have everything. You may not have a lot, but you've got people. You've got a support structure. And your aspirations are also simplistic.
Exactly.
You know, as long as I've got a meal on my table, as long as my kids are fed, they can go to a school, I'm fine.
Yeah.
I'm okay. I also think that like society's expectations of us. And maybe if we want to really get philosophical, maybe like capitalism and pursuing more and, you know, being more competitive. And because 200-300 years ago, Africa was fine. By all means, it was fine. People lived.
Mm-hmm.
They lived in their communities. They lived off the land. They enjoyed their lives.
Yeah, yeah.
Even if it was short because of disease or whatever, there wasn't as much, let's say, technological advancement. But, hey, you lived a decent life and you died. Now, we're living till we're 80. That means we have to worry to live to 80. So we have to work to until we're 65, build up enough wealth so that not only can we take care of ourselves, but give our progeny something to also look after themselves with or build on. I think it's a lot of pressure.
Yeah. So if you don't have the skills or you're not trained in how to deal with that, like you're saying, you know, we've moved to that point of individualism very quickly. We had community in the early 90s where everybody was, you know what I mean? And then when we started urbanizing like rapidly, Sandton started blowing up very quickly. Mm. You know what I mean? If you look at the level of wealth that has been created, especially amongst the ultra wealthy in this country, it's unprecedented. I don't think anywhere in the world people have gotten so rich so quickly. And things have changed in the way we live at such scale. You know what I mean?
So basically capitalism. So that's you think that's part of the reason why?
I mean, there's ways to manage it. I mean, there's ways to manage it. It's not just capitalism and development. I mean, you know, there's places like Gaza where people are not killing each other. Killing themselves. even though there's bombs dropping and, you know, people would say...
Yeah, it's crazy. Like, when you think about it there, I mean, you've got a war-torn country where life is worse than it is.
You lost 10 of your kids, but you're still not killing yourself.
You literally just lost 10 of your children. Why aren't you also going like,
But, you know, and it's especially relevant to you guys, like in the medical field. You got doctors that are going there, you know what I mean? Like risking their lives, you know, as well. I mean, shout out to the Hippocratic Oath, but, you know, that's a daunting task.
I mean, so that's why now when we speak about mental health, we're like, so it can't just be about your circumstances, right?
Mm.
Because there's a lot at play, yeah.
Because if it was just purely circumstances, the suicide rate in, for example, Gaza would be like the highest.
Yeah.
Because life, you've got no access to food, water, sanitation, you're being bombed, you've lost your home. but nobody, you're not, yeah. you know, exactly. there's not an escalated rise of suicide there. Mm. So it's got to be something like deeply rooted in our society.
Yeah. Yeah, but
and the culture of our society and maybe what we are trying to aspire to or what we value as important in our lives. I don't think that we've had a time in our history where suicide has been as prevalent as it is now. I stand to be corrected. We can pull up the stats.
Yeah.
But it's like we are in the time of our lives where we have probably the best chance of survival, yet we want to kill ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, if you think about not even 150 years ago, most people, even like wealthy people, didn't have access to water every single day. Mm. 150 years ago,
mm.
right? Mm. They didn't have like access to a fridge. You know,
just to keep a
decent toilet. And like,
yeah.
we've got. For a lot of people, you've got all of those things now, but you're still sad.
Yeah. So I think you touched on something very important about societal demands, you know, and just the man and the male figure, what society demands from you. And the fact that, you know, most of us are raised in communities where you're told, indodaikhali, you know. Which means, you know,
men don't
cry.
Yes,
I wouldn't advise crying too much. Like I also find, like, you know, the thing is this, right? He was talking about like the high rate of suicide. I think a substantial part of the suicide right now is because it's so popular. Like, if you see so many people killing themselves, and then you see people, especially celebrities, you know, they commit suicide
specifically.
They're just in general. Like, okay. Now that you're seeing it a lot more, you know what I mean? I've had like close associates, you know, who've also died by suicide. There's people in the comedy field as well who've died by suicide. A lot of them, Robin Williams, you know, he was one of the most famous comics. But when he did it, it was shocking, right? Heath Ledger also, he died. It was also shocking. We think it's a suicide or an overdose. You know what I mean? There was Whitney Houston. Those were isolated cases in the celebrity sphere. But of late, and especially since COVID, we've seen so many that it seems like some people feel like they'll have the peace once they know that they finally have their moment where people actually care about them or give them attention. And they get
so you
to
feel
see
like
that.
It's an act of, for some.
No, I'm thinking that more and more.
Everyone.
Yes, more and more.
So people, you think that people are like, this gives me the attention that I seek.
I don't think that they intentionally do that, but I feel like the removing of the shame for committing acts of suicide, you know what I mean? Culturally, the way in which we speak about suicide, the way in which we coddle people, you know what I mean? I feel like we do too much. I mean, even maliciously, we've got family members, sometimes some of us in dysfunctional families, where a family member will threaten suicide, or a teenage child will threaten to kill themselves if they don't have access to their phone. Those were not normal. I mean, when I was a teenager, I threatened to kill myself, my mother would be like, hold on, do you want me to throw you over the bridge or like in a river? Like, which way? And be quick, because, you know, I've got night shift. You know what I mean? So like, it would be a ridiculous thing to say, like, you're not going to blackmail your parents by threatening suicide. And because of the way in which we focus on mental health symptomatically instead of like causally, you know what I mean, or preventatively, you know, we miss out on actually what is the issue with people. And the issue with people is that they're not being taught to deal with their own emotions. They're not being taught how to you know, grow up into being proper adults. And I mean, life can be very stressful, you know. It's just speaking from my own experience, you know, maybe over the past 5-6 years, right? I've traveled a lot, you know, I've done a lot of business, I've gone through whatever successes, failures, you know, I got married and divorced, you know, and divorce is like one of the biggest wealth killers. Wealth killing is one of the biggest, you know, suicide causes, you know what I mean? If you ever over indebted or you lose your money, you know. Even back in the day before people were addicted to their smartphones, there were Wall Street bankers jumping off buildings at the crash of the markets. You know what I mean? So to be able to go through all those things and yet to have the skills that were trained in me since I was a child, you know what I mean, to be able to cope, you know what I mean, to be able to wake up in the morning with a positive attitude and feel like I can show up. You know, it takes a certain level of skill. You need to be trained for that. And other people just don't have the benefit of that. And, you know, I just feel so like it's like unfair that not everyone got through the same schooling programming as I did. I mean, my school was founded by an educational psychologist, Professor Shirley Cockett. She's actually a professor in child psychology. And that's what she founded it for, to like strengthen young minds, especially those that are neurodivergent or have got other learning abilities or unorthodox learning abilities. So with that, I feel our suicide and our mental health crisis needs to be something that's solved at a junior level. The same way we solve our rugby player crisis at primary school sports, the same way we solve our cricketing crisis. You know what I mean? Those are the things that we start. We don't say, oh no, Orlando Pirates is terrible. Damn it. Let's recruit all the 21-year-olds in the country and then train them. No, you start at the grassroots level. And unless we're training kids to be strong mentally, like as children, right, then we're not going to have capable adults. And unfortunately, the world that we live in right now demands much more capable adults than ever before. So our parents are the worst positioned to train their kids. And therefore, we need the expertise of doctors, psychologists to collaborate, especially with educators. You know, we need our doctors to come in to the schools.
100%. Yeah. Tell me, so, how did like divorce affect you?
Oh, well, I mean, divorce is the... Like, as a man...
And let me just ask you candidly, did you ever go through a difficult enough time? Because one of the things, literally, if somebody comes into our rooms in the emergency unit, we have what's called the sad person score. And it's an acronym, and the D stands for divorce. Right? It gives you 2 points on a risk stratification for whether you are at high risk for suicide.
Yeah.
So divorce is something that... S is for sex, male or female.
Yeah,
and male gives you an extra point than female.
Yeah,
so it's something that's really really crucial to one's mental health.
Yeah, yeah,
and it can be really difficult. So
yeah, I mean that's the thing is that you know the failure of the relationship is not the failure of you as a human being, and I guess the goal with marriage is that, you know, you're going to start a family, you're going to start your own lineage. So a lot is resting on that, you know what I mean? The fact that your family name will be carried on is resting on that, you know what I mean? That's your biological, you know, imperative to reproduce, you know? So it's hardwired into you. And therefore, you know, any person that threatens that, you know, is in like a certain level of mortal danger, because it's like, you know, you're ending the reason why I'm alive, you know what I mean? Which is to reproduce and, you know, be plentiful. So that is hard to accept, you know, for starters. And then I guess you then try to pathologize what could have brought someone to feeling as if your relationship has got no future, you know what I mean? Or the issues that you've got in your relationship are irreparable. And once you start going through that process, you know, you give yourself a little bit of leeway. You see your own faults, you know, how you contributed to the situation. And then you also accept that, you know, no human being is perfect. And therefore, there are other things that maybe were incompatible with the person that you are trying to build a partnership with. And then once you've gone through that process, you start to accept that you don't put yourself in any better position to recover unless you improve on yourself. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
you need to be able to show up. And if you're going to attract another wife, you know, your first wife can't be the death of you. You know what I mean? You need to come back up and show up and present as an attractive
person. Did you guys have kids?
No. I didn't have kids. Yeah.
So look, I mean, there's also some of the other stuff that we wanted to touch on with you surrounding mental health. We did some reading before the this interview. Apparently, there's been accusations that you have denied about you having some sort of a mental health diagnosis. Is that true? Are
no.
Comfortable talking?
Yeah, no, I'm good. No, I haven't had a mental health diagnosis.
Mm.
Yeah, but
the article I saw said that people are saying you're bipolar.
Is there
some reason why they may be saying that?
No, that's just people on social media.
Oh, okay.
So, while I was going through probably my separation, especially in the early stages, in the early stages of my separation, you know, I lost a close friend. And then because of the drama surrounding that loss, you know, my family got...
This close friend was it, AKA?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So because of the drama surrounding the loss, you know what I mean? My family was just attacked by a whole lot of rich people that wanted to silence me. So, you know, it's the nature of our business. So
what do you mean they wanted to silence you?
They tried to have me declared mentally unfit so that they could basically take my access to any money, any means to be able to travel or whatever, so they could threaten my life.
But you why? Know? Why would they want to do that?
I mean, why would they want to kill AKA, right? Same reason, you know. So,
Do you have an idea of, like, why they would want to kill AKA?
I don't have a close idea as to exactly why, but, you know, like I said, I grew up exposed to the elites of this country, and the way in which they move or they do things is that if they're offended by someone in some way, or they feel like someone could be a liability or threaten them in some way, they get rid of them. And if you get rid of someone as big as AKA, what it says to anyone that understands how the underworld works, right, is that if you've taken a big scalp, you're a big boss.
Mm.
You know what I mean? And that basically lets everybody else know. And if you're able to get away with it, then that lets everybody else know how high up your connections go, you know? So I felt like that was the situation with him. And I felt like because he comes from a family that was not politically exposed or exposed to the elites, you know, no one was going to speak for him. And because so many other people, you know, are fearful of politically connected people, they wouldn't speak for him either. And so they sent me to involuntary, they Section 33'd me, sent me to involuntary admission, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I was at somewhere in...
This is after you what spoke out?
In Reimsich, yeah. Mm. I forgot, some life, whatever. I was there for like 4 days. Well, they could keep me for 72 hours. And then after the 72 hours elapsed, they asked for another opinion, a fourth opinion, I guess, for the fourth day. And then they kept me for observation for a fourth day. And then I was given an assessment. And then I was completely cleared. They checked me for a whole lot of things, whether schizophrenia, you know, bipolar, any of those things. So I was completely cleared of all of those. And I was happy that, you know, I was cleared of all of those. But I wasn't happy with, you know, being put behind a steel door, and then they, you know, they tranquilize you. When you get there, they tranquilize you, you know what I mean? Like, they offer you tea. I actually burnt myself with rooibos tea because I passed out while drinking the tea and I spilled it on my thigh. Mm. After that experience, I had another test for myself. Like, I could also assess, like, oh, maybe am I overreacting? Am I reacting emotionally? Is what I'm thinking rational? And I had a lot of time to come out of that. So, you know, it's just always sensitive when people do make, you know, such accusations of, you know, dealing with this, because I have, through, you know, either my marriage or previous relationships, you know, being in a relationship with people who are struggling, either they're chronically medicated for anything, whether it be bipolar, I've dealt with like maybe three people that I've had relationships that were struggling with bipolar, one of whom refused to, you know, get assessed and checked out properly while we were together, and two of whom...
You sympathize with...
Yeah. I understand the challenge, and over time, I understand the level of the sickness that, you know, if you ever have a close friend or someone that's close, like, it's better if they're a relative, a blood relative. You know what I mean? You don't want to go through a friendship where you've got a friend that's struggling with a mental health illness. I mean, the only thing worse than that is a friend that's struggling with a severe drug addiction. You know what I mean? And
have you experienced that too?
I guess, but they ultimately led to jail and suicide death. Mm. So.
Well, speaking of, because you raised it, I was also remembering you actually were charged with contempt of court and were in prison for 60 days.
That was because of that AKA case. Yes.
So what was the contempt of court?
Mm. The contempt of court was that I was in an institution.
But what was the charge placed against you?
No, that there was an immediate interdict or something. I don't know. I was either supposed to withdraw a statement or something, but I was in the institution at the time.
Okay.
So that was impossible. Mm. And then I was out of the country as well. Mm. By the time that judgment, I was in the United States when that judgment that I should be, you know, arrested happened.
So then when you came back, were you arrested?
Yeah, when I landed back. In fact, I even had to deal with it this past weekend. I was on my way to Zambia, and I ended up not traveling on the Friday that I was supposed to travel because they had my face up on that Interpol Nkwazi notice. So I had to have that removed, and, you know, I had a speaking engagement in Zambia that day, but I managed to travel the next day and have that whole entire thing removed, so... So that was
and tell me how was prison, man?
Yeah,
you see, that? So that's the thing. I think that's, you see, a lot of my insights about mental health and all that. That's exactly, like, I feel like we need a lot more mental health clinics, or we need to extend all the hospitals so that we can empty out the prisons, because that's actually the problem that we have in the prisons is people that don't have the skills to cope with either struggling to find work, struggling to find a means of getting
income. I'm just wondering what type of people you met and like what were your experiences?
It was the worst thing ever. You know what I mean? You don't want to go through such an experience because the thing is that you're now in an environment with people you don't actually want to meet and be in a confined space.
I'm
there for contempt of court or whatever the case may be, but you know, there's other people who are there, like there's a serial rapist who's got 17 life sentences. You know, there's a young kid who's 20 years old and is there for a double murder, stabbed someone, and is a crystal meth addict. And you know what I mean? There's like every worst thing you could imagine inside there. So I was only in there for 18 days. And, you know, I had to keep my mental health strong. It's not the type of environment that you'd wish on your worst enemy. But if you're strong mentally, you know, funny thing is that I feel like us as men, we know who we can reach out to for help or assistance or who can help us get through some complex things that are going on in our heads. And for a lot of the guys, because I didn't come from an environment where I was involved in criminality, go up and down, or violence or anything else, they saw me as like a guy who's like got a blank slate, you know what I mean? And, you know, I got to speak to a lot of guys, and just by having conversations and speaking to a lot of guys, I felt like, you know, they warmed to me because they felt they could express themselves. And I just told myself, let me not be judgmental of the reasons why people are here, because I don't want to, you know, turn someone off. You know what I mean? Also, you don't understand their mental acuity. You know what I mean? They might not understand that a normal person who's never been involved in crime looks at a criminal and thinks, you're a criminal. Mm. Like, why are you talking to me? You know what I mean? He might think, but we're all in here together. Like, we're the same, right? We're all in orange. So I didn't want to trigger anyone. So I had to be very mature about how I present myself, you know, keep to myself unless someone approaches me. And even when someone approaches me, don't be too friendly or, I guess, let your guard down. And yeah, also experiencing that and understanding a large part. Because the funniest thing is that, you know, a lot of the people that we see or that we experience that go through mental health issues, right? If they end up dead, we can never actually speak to them or whatever. If they end up in prison because they've done something, also it's limited. You can't just always visit.
Yeah, but you had the opportunity to speak.
Now
yeah.
I had to, you understand what I'm saying?
And what was so, like some of the craziest experiences you had in prison?
Whoo!
Just briefly, because we're almost
yeah,
out
okay,
of time.
Okay, sorry. So the craziest experience was like there's this guy, right, who's in prison for murdering the mother of his child.
Yeah.
Or his girl or ex-girlfriend.
Okay.
His ex-girlfriend. And like he is like or was a fan or is a fan of my ex-wife. You know what I mean? And he was in maximum security prison in Bloemfontein many years ago for the murder that he committed. And she did her first like actual tour in Bloemfontein, like when her career was launched. So he's been a fan since they even had posters inside his cell over there. So he'd
that
like
must have been weird.
Yeah, he'd like whistle her songs like at like 2 a.m. in the morning. And he'd like he also wouldn't sleep. And then like he kept telling me that I didn't know that he'd killed his the mother of his child or anything at before I spoke to him. So he's like, hey man, I want you to see someone. I know someone that looks almost exactly like your ex-wife. And I was like, what? So then he showed me the pictures. And then, like, while paging through the flip file with the pictures, I realized that, damn, all of these pictures are old pictures. So clearly this person is no longer alive. And then I figured, okay, maybe her not being alive is the reason why this guy is here. Let me not... you know, that's the weirdest thing. So I'm paging through, and I was like, you know what? They could be twins.
Seriously.
Look nothing like each other, but I mean, I didn't want to trigger him in that experience.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he said something that was also very triggering. So he's like, yeah, so like, yeah, I read that you got divorced. Like, why did you get divorced? It's like, well, I didn't get divorced. I was divorced. She divorced me. And then he said, and you allowed her? You know what I mean? He's like, what? He's like, what do you mean? He's like, what? That means you didn't love her. If she left me like that, I would have killed her.
Yeah.
And I was like,
that's okay, why
you're
now here. It makes sense.
That's why
now we know why you're here.
That's why you're here. And I was like, well, I guess I didn't love her. I didn't. Yeah. I guess. I mean, like, what am I going to say?
So, and you stayed with these type of people.
What could I do? You know, you're stuck there. The one was in the bunk underneath me. You know, he was also in there for, he'd been in there for, well, he was sentenced to 25 years, but this was his 20th year for his murder charge as well. You know, I got to see all of these people. There's people who are once rapists, murderers, who are now preachers as well, which, you know, also, you know, I had to pretend as if that's cool. You know, it's not.
And then when you come out, how did you cope? How do you survive?
Yeah. You know,
was there any trauma, post-traumatic?
Yeah, like were you ever under threat in jail? Did anybody try to hurt you?
No.
You know,
no.
We hear the stories about dropping the soap.
Yeah, no. Well, I mean, you guys are doctors, so you would know. Because, I mean, a lot of them end up in your hospitals after incidents happen. So,
but nothing like that happened.
Yeah, they never come for that. Yeah.
Well, I mean, yeah. I'm fortunate. My family has got a lot of skin in the game. So, you know, where I went there, you know, there's lots of cousins of mine that are inside
also
prison.
Inside.
that have been
okay,
inside.
Okay, so you're fine. You're protected.
Yeah. And I wasn't there for long enough to start any beefs or have any troubles with anyone. So the wardens wanted me in and out quickly, and so did the rest of the prisoners so that they can continue with their business without being watched because of me.
Yeah.
Well, cool. Well, look, that's all we have time for now. But before we end off the episode, we always like to leave with something a little bit lighthearted. We react to videos. So let's see what videos you guys have for us this week. And we'll just give our most natural reactions.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Good, perfect. That's a good one right there.
What is
it? Shoot this whole book. And here comes Kaja.
Yo, are they injecting the eye? Why?
Good. Okay. Nice work. Sweet.
That's great work.
You still getting lots of views? Right. Oh, yeah. There's like, now there's like so many people who are like, oh my God. Like, that just looks so like, that's so crazy. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah? What's
that?
Yeah.
So that's called an intravitreal injection. So it's just an injection at the back of your eye. It's a common injection. We do it for any, if there's a blocked vessel, if there's bleeding at the back of the eye, if there's swelling at the back of the eye. It's like treatment for the back part of your eye.
But like, yo.
But what's I think what's trending about this video is that normally you would have someone lying down in like a sterile sort of environment with, you know, like a procedure. I mean, this guy is doing it in a slit lamp. You know, this person is sitting with their doctor right next to them. Opens
but now
your
there's
eye,
no anesthetic first. There's no anesthetic first, so that
I'm sure they put. There's
but
no way they wouldn't.
What, but like topical anesthetic.
Yeah, so they put a topical anesthetic, and then that brownish.
So you can feel something piercing your eyeball.
No, not really. You feel pressure, but not pain. Good.
Yeah, because I could just.
Yeah, no, she would have jumped. She would have jumped.
And what do they actually inject into the vitreous?
So there's the main thing that we inject is anti-VEGF. So it's anti.
Okay.
What is VEGF?
Vascular endothelial growth
factor. Yeah. So I don't. Do you want me to get into that? No, it's too much.
No, it's too much. We know you know your work.
No. So basically, if the back part of your eye is ischemic for whatever reason,
so it has a lack of blood.
It starts producing abnormal vessels, and in order to stop that, abnormal vessels damage the eye. You don't want any abnormal vessels in the back of the eye.
Yeah.
So in order to stop that, we give anti-VEGF, which is anti-growth factor, if I may put it that way.
Can't you take the blood thinning, like the stuff that you take if you're
orally,
having a stroke?
Won't work as well.
Yeah. No, it won't. Because you need it in the eye.
You need it directly in the eye.
In your entire body.
I hate injections.
Body.
Right?
Yeah. It could also just be antibiotic
injection,
which is uncommon.
Cool. Next video.
A mental institution museum of some sort.
Yeah, like a museum, like people just walk through.
People are walking and saying, oh, look at this one. Oh, look at that one.
That doesn't look right.
No,
something about that doesn't feel right.
Yeah. No, I don't know. That doesn't look like any.
It felt like a theater production there. People are allowed to walk through and, like, you're not allowed to pull out your phone and just film all these people.
Well,
and
maybe
kids.
They're waiting for the
someone carrying a
therapist.
Kid and saying, oh, look at this one.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, sometimes at these cycles, there's the occupational therapist time, and then they just allow you to do whatever until you
have to have the bar so open so he can, like, touch. No way. Next video. How many videos you have? 3. All right, cool. Let's see.
Wow, loco. Esto, vale. Dios mío. Ey, pero no le pueden poner un medicamento.
What are these people smoking?
I have no idea, man.
That happened to a friend of mine, like, but we were kids. So he jumped onto the railing at Olivedale Clinic, like, and brought the whole entire rail down because they wanted to
stitch. Wait, but did he?
He was still a kid.
So he's just a naughty kid.
They tried to stitch him because the dog bit him, but punctured close to his lung. And then he ran, and then he was like, oh, they're hurting my heart. Yeah, so I don't know. You doctors deal with that. Sometimes when you're dealing with kids, don't they like get rowdy?
Yeah,
of course.
Yeah. Yeah, depersonalization, derealization, that's hectic. You feel it like feels like you are, when people describe it, they say it feels like you are outside of your body looking at your body. Like you are that, you have that little, that little autonomy over your own body that it feels like you are somebody witnessing your own body. And stuff is just happening.
And are they what, on substances?
Or? Not even. Some people actually just have this disorder. They're born with it. It's very, very rare. Very, very rare. But it is something. And obviously with substances that can happen. Well, that's all we have time for this week. It's been a great episode, Nota. And we must have you back to talk more about your interesting and controversial life.
No, thank you.
But thank you for joining us this week. We will definitely have you back again soon.
Yeah.
That's it from me. Dr. Soyil Essa signing off.
Dr. Ntandla Vilakazi signing out.
And I'm not a doctor. But I'm signing off in good health.
We'll catch you next week. Cheers.